All right, so if you're in the right place, this is CS50 AP and the AP CSP framework. So our course is completely mapped to College Board's AP Computer Science Principles course. And essentially, we are what is considered an endorsed provider, which means if you attend this workshop or any endorsed provider's professional development, it counts as instead of a summer institute that's provided by the College Board. So essentially, this is all you would need to teach AP CSP. All right, so if you haven't seen my email already, all of the slides from today and from this weekend will be posted online via this link. So feel free to visit that. But again, all of you should have it in your email. I like personally to take notes with the slides. So if you're that type of person, then feel free to do that. All right, so the framework lives at this URL. We actually have a few books for all of you that also has the framework. Vin, if you wouldn't mind, in that big black suitcase, there are some purple books against the back wall. Yep. So we have some books for all of you that has the complete framework, all of the big ideas, all of the learning objectives, all of the essential knowledge statements for the course. I believe there are some 300 essential knowledge statements. So feel free to peruse through that. So the course essentially consists of 7 big ideas, 24 enduring understandings, 44 learning objectives, and 312 essential knowledge statements. So all of these are in that purple book, and these are what curriculum have to be mapped to in order to be considered an endorsed provider. So every single content item that you produce has to be mapped, and you have to be mapped to every single one of these items. There are also computational thinking practices and 2 through course assignments, the create task and the explore task, which we'll dive into a little bit later today. The AP exam this year will be held on May 10th, 2018. So Margaret, who you'll see in the back, was on our team of AP readers in Kansas City this year, so she was one of the teachers who graded some of those performance tasks.
Is that actually May 11th?
May 11th? I can double check.
It was a Friday.
Yeah, May 11th. I think next year is going to be May 10th.
Oh, I may have just forgotten to change the year. Thanks for catching. All right. So in terms of curricular requirements, these are just items that the College Board wants to ensure that their providers are telling instructors who will be teaching the course. So it's just a lot of big phrases to basically say that you're providing your students with opportunities to learn all of the essential things that are necessary for this course. So they have access to the internet, they have computers, that sort of thing. And in terms of, that's where resource requirements come in. So at least have access to internet at school. That's why you'll notice that in the requirements for the explore and the create task, you're required to give students classroom time to work, because it isn't necessary that students have internet at home. All right, so our big ideas for the course, the first one is creativity. So this is one where we're sort of talking about how students are essentially using computer science to express themselves in other fields. So as David mentioned earlier, we have a piece set called Music at the university, and it sort of ties together computational thinking with reading sheet music. So it's one of those situations where students would sort of need to bridge the gap between 2 content areas, leveraging some of the things that we get to use in computer science. So that would be one example of using creativity, tying in something like music or art into their final project. Then we move on to abstraction. So David talked earlier about those zeros and ones inside of our computer. And essentially, our computers only know binary. So how can we represent a movie or even a picture if we just have zeros and ones? Well, first we can build them into decimal numbers. And then maybe we can use those to make hexadecimal numbers. And then maybe those we can create colors. And then with colors, we can create lines of colors. And then lines could become pictures. And all of that is building on this idea of abstraction that even though at the very core it is still zeros and ones, can we do much more complex things with those zeros and ones? All right. So we're really focusing on modeling the world and communicating with people. So modeling those more complex things within our world, just with those zeros and ones inside of our computer. So for example, we have this algorithm for drawing what? Anyone want to take a stab at what this algorithm would do? It's drawing a square. So it's kind of assuming a lot. It's kind of assuming, one, we know what an inch is, so that could be considered an abstraction. It's also assuming we know what up, down, left, and right are, which is another abstraction that we have assigned because we're humans. And then also, I mean, a little bit even more of an abstraction, a pen. Maybe if we were in a different universe or a different galaxy, we wouldn't even know what a pen is. So all of these things are just constraints that we as humans have defined. This too might be a little bit more specific, something similar to what you might see in a math classroom with our coordinates. So we have X and Y's, maybe a little bit more specific. As we will discover, computers aren't that great at figuring out what you're telling it to do. So they take no liberties to interpret what you're trying to say. All they will do is do exactly what you said at exactly the time you said it. And sometimes it breaks, and sometimes it works, but that's just how our computers function. And then too, layering even one more layer of abstraction, so we could draw each section individually and sort of build that out. But if a human knows what a square is, why don't we just tell them to draw a square? So this would be the simplest way of drawing that. Then we move on to data and information. So in data and information, we want students to be able to work with data. So one of our problem sets is building a stock trading website. So they're using APIs, specifically Yahoo's API, and pulling stock prices and having to deal with users' information as well as the actual stock prices and those stock abbreviations, and being able to store all of that in a database and being able to query it and access it and work with that data. So we feel that that type of knowledge is important for students, especially those who want to go into a computing workforce where they might need to deal with very big data sets in the real world, particularly with sensitive information, like if you have users storing passwords or credit cards on their platform. All right. So then we talk about algorithms, and those algorithms are what we saw earlier with the square, right? So giving the computer a very specific set of instructions, so students should be able to develop those on their own. I believe in the create task, students need to create an original algorithm, so they do need to have something that they've written themselves. There are portions of the task where they can take stuff from the internet, but they need to cite it properly. But they do need to learn how to write those specific instructions for the computer to understand. And then the next big idea is programming. So all of those things we sort of talked about fall into the lens of programming. So we look at abstractions through the lens of programming. Or we look at algorithms through the lens of programming. So what does that mean? It means that while we can have those plain English instructions, draw a square, move your pen up 1 inch, well, how are we going to represent that to the computer? Because the computer doesn't understand place pen on paper, move pen up 1 inch. How are we going to break it down into the syntax that the computer needs to understand to actually perform those tasks? And then near the end, we have the internet. So the internet, the students have likely been on the internet before. They're familiar with how they use it, specifically with social media, Googling around. And so do we cover not only what happens when you visit the internet or what happens when you visit a website, but specifically what security issues do you face when you're on the internet, talk about cybersecurity, and how to build in secure features into your own products. And then lastly, global impact. So this sort of gets woven in between all of the big ideas, because in the world that we live in today, computers take up so much of our lives, right? We have computers in front of us, our laptops. We have computers in our pockets, our phones. We have computers on our wrists. Some of you have the Apple Watch. So they're everywhere. So how does that impact our life? One example of the global impact for the, I think it was the Explore test that we see a lot, is the self-driving cars. So even that would be an example of how are these affecting our society and humans and even the economy, and how computing really can shift those either in a good direction or in a bad direction. All right, so we really want to focus on how it enables innovation, but also potential risks that innovation may have in society. So those are our big ideas. And in terms of the CS50 curriculum, we sort of focus everything through the lens of programming. In other AP CSP curricula, you'll see that some of these are focused through programming and some of them are not. So for example, if you weren't focusing the internet section on programming, you might just do some reading or some research on different things in the internet. But we like to give students some hands-on examples so that are programming things that could be used on the internet. All right, so then we move on to our computational thinking practices. So the first is connecting computing, creating computational artifacts. So these sort of things aren't on the same level as the big ideas. So the big ideas sort of talk directly to the curriculum itself, whereas the computational thinking practices are sort of interspersed into all of the units, and they just sort of highlight what we want students to get out of those big ideas, if that makes sense. So how are you going to create a computational artifact? How are you going to create that program itself? How are you going to abstract things? And these are all like at a very high level. How are you going to analyze problems and artifacts? Specifically for the explore task, students have to analyze some already existing innovation and talk about its risks and benefits. And you need to be able to do research that to figure that stuff out. They need to cite sources. Communicating, so it may be all fine and good if you can write a program that works, but it's essentially useless if no one else can understand how it works. So we have students comment their code, making sure that if someone didn't understand computer science, they might still be able to understand what's happening just by reading through the comments of your code. And we find that that's really important for students being able to articulate the complex structures of their actual assignments. And then collaborating. So a big focus for the APCSP framework is having students collaborate with each other, being able to pair program, and sort of look at someone else's code and be able to either understand what's going on or being able to identify potential areas where you might be confused or where bugs may exist in a student's code. And that's one of the more helpful features I've found when I've gotten stuck on a program is having someone else take a look at it, because having a fresh eyes on it is always very helpful for finding those bugs. All right, so we have two through course assessments. We have our explore. So this is a writing assignment. So students will have to research a current issue that is investigating the implications of that technology's impact on society. And that's 16% of their overall AP score. So as you may know, the AP test or the AP score itself is a 5-point scale. So a 5 meaning that you've completed it to the best score that you could possibly get, and a 1 being the lowest score you could possibly get. The explore task, we encourage students to look at the rubric. Very few of them do. But as Margaret and some of the other teachers who have been teaching it know, the rubric is very specific in what it's asking for. So having students read through that first before they even attempt to write is very helpful in order to get them full points on this section. And even too with the create task. So the create task is where a student is building an application or a program of their own, and they can do this in any medium that they want. We've had students submit projects in Scratch or in C or in Python or a website. So it can really be any of those formats. Students just need to write about what they're doing in that website, and actually it's almost more, the writing portion of it is almost more heavily graded than the actual program itself. So really having them focus on how to articulate what is going on is really important in the create task. And that's a little bit chunkier of their score. It's 24% of their overall 5-point grade. So the AP exam is that multiple choice exam at the end of the year. And that is approximately 76 multiple choice questions. So once you do the course audit for the College Board, you'll have access to, I believe, 2 practice exams. They have not made the past exams viewable online yet, so these practice exams that they give you on your portal are essentially what you have to work with to prepare your students for this multiple choice section. They cover 6 of the 7 big ideas because obviously it's kind of difficult to evaluate someone's creativity in multiple choice. So I believe some of the multiple choice questions are also those pick 2. So it's like, here are 4 answers, pick 2 of the 4 that do a certain thing, and they won't give you partial credit. So it's all or nothing. So being able to have your students look at those and be able to interpret what the question is actually asking is a pretty key skill, especially if they're not in another AP course, like AP Lit. So approximately 20% is on algorithms, 20% is on programming, 18% on abstraction, 18% on data and information, and 12% for internet and global impact. And then in terms of our curriculum, we have 9 sort of chapters, we call them, 7 of which are core chapters. So those 7 chapters are what we deem essential to the curriculum. And we have 2 optional chapters, or 2 fast track chapters. And those are sort of for the students who maybe want to work independently on their own, or you have a class of students who maybe have had some prior experience and they need something extra to sort of really dive into. And those 2 chapters could either be self-paced in that model that I described earlier, or as an entire class. So we do provide you with lots of resources. So we have videos, written resources, in-class exercises, and problem sets. And if you've already dove into the edX course online, you'll see that there are many more resources than we could even list in a slide deck. This slide here is what your teacher portal looks like currently. It is undergoing a little bit of a facelift this summer, so it may not look like this by next school year, but currently, it has 2 fields at the top, 2 drop-down menus. One is for the chapter, and one is for the module. Students have complete access to this entire site, so they don't need to log in. In fact, only the teachers need to register for a site. So most of you already do have a teacher account on our portal. But essentially, all the teacher account lets you do is be able to create your own homepage. So it would be ap.cs50.net/your username, and that's how students view your specific content that you've sort of pinned to your class. So you don't have to show them, you know, chapters 0 through 6 and all of the modules in between if you don't want to overwhelm them. Maybe you just show them chapter 0 and a few of the resources just to really narrow their focus on what you want them to actually look at. So the different categories, you have videos, written resources, and that sort of thing. And those vary depending on what module you're actually in on the site. And then we have 50 problems. We include a mix of writing and programming problems. So the writing problems are really there to prepare students for that explore task. And we've often found that teachers have given us the feedback that go ahead and get the explore task out of the way as soon as possible. You know, do those writing assignments early so that once you get into programming and working in the CS50 IDE, which we'll hear about later, then you're not stuck having to like take the break of, I think it's the 8 hours required of class time for the explore. And then students come back and they're like, oh, I don't know how to open a file because it's been so long. Or I don't know what my bug is because I don't remember syntax. So it sort of just helps with the flow to sort of get all of the writing out of the way up front. We offer sort of different variations of those problems. This year was the first year that we released less and more comfy problems for our AP audience. So AP, just by the nature of how we produce our curriculum for all of you, is always 1 school year behind CS50 in the fall here at Harvard, because it would be crazy for me to go online and have to update, like, essentially in real time what David is doing in class. It would be very tedious and a lot of hard work. And as many of you may know, I wear different hats at CS50, so I'm not solely devoted to AP in the fall. I have some other responsibilities. But we offer those different variations so that students can sort of pick and choose, almost like a choose-your-own-adventure book, if you're familiar. and they don't have to stick to one specific path. So sort of the beauty of it is that if you're starting out and you're like, oh, I don't know if I should like be doing less or more comfy, they can start off doing something for less comfortable students. And then later in the course, as they get more familiar, as they feel more comfortable, they can decide, oh, you know what? I'm going to challenge myself this week, and I'm going to do the more comfy this week. And if they feel, hey, this is too much, they can always revert back to the less comfy. So we always make both options available for students in every context that we offer it. And then our final project, so this is a term that we sort of use here on campus for our students at the end of the year, but it maps nicely to the AP Create task that students are expected to complete before April 30th, I believe is the cutoff date, which they will need to submit on College Board's digital portfolio, which has been sort of buggy around April 30th. So I would definitely encourage your students to submit as early as they possibly can, just because... Excuse me? Yes. It sort of will time out and things will sort of get clunky on their end. So definitely like try and get your students to submit as soon as they're ready or they've completed their project. So our chapters are those seven chapters that I discussed earlier with the two optional chapters. And the first one is computers and computing. So sort of here we dive into more of a hardware aspect of the course. What's actually inside of your computer? How does it actually work? What is ASCII? What are algorithms? But all at a very basic level. This is where their first writing assignment is. So they talk about abstraction and algorithms, but all from a conceptual point of view rather than a programming point of view. So it's like just making sure that they understand at a high level what's going on. And then we go into the building blocks of programming. As we talked about earlier, all of our the ways that we sort of direct those big ideas are through that lens of programming. So we very early on address programming itself. And we start in Scratch, so it's that drag and drop block language that some of you may have used in PSET 0 on edX. And then we move into pseudocoding. So pseudocoding is like what David had on the screen earlier when we were doing the phone book example. So flip to middle of book, determine whether Mike Smith is on the right side or left side, and then throw the opposite side away. So those human-like phrases are what we call pseudocoding, and they're almost like the outline of your code. If you've ever taught in an English class, sometimes students will like outline their different body paragraphs and how it ties back to their thesis. And pseudocoding is a way to do that and organize your program before you even start writing actual code. And then we talk about variables and loops and conditions. But again, variables in a sense of just a container to hold that value. So students don't really need to have a super in-depth knowledge of math per se. They just need to know what a variable is. And that could be defined in your classroom. That doesn't even need to come from a math background. And the big ideas addressed here are creativity and programming. So in Scratch, it's a completely open project. They could develop whatever they want. So we've had students build like dancing pandas to, I know one student, he got really into the Scratch project and was using cloud variables, which I didn't even know existed when I was looking at his project. But he had like a multiplayer online game that was a replica of this like PS4 game that he was really interested in. And I thought that it was crazy that he could replicate that in Scratch because I didn't even know that you could do that. And then, so those we covered those like basic building blocks. But now we want to talk about, okay, we know what a variable is, we know what an algorithm is. How can we sort of piece those pieces together in a meaningful way? So chapter two is putting those blocks together, and we talk about functions and arrays and command line interaction, debugging specifically, because it is inevitable that your students will encounter bugs. And what are some strategies that you can get them to work around those actual bugs that exist in their code? And we do find that a lot of students struggle with functions and writing them specifically, or even interpreting how they work in their code. So we do feel that that's one of the areas to spend a little bit of extra time there, just so students are really comfortable writing those functions and understanding how they work in their actual programs. The next chapter is thinking computationally. And so here do we sort of, this is a great opportunity to do a lot of student demos. So in lecture, David will often have students hold up numbers. So he'll have like 0 through 8. and they'll use the different algorithms to sort themselves. So they'll have to use like bubble sort or insertion sort or selection sort. And just seeing that physical representation of how these items are moving in a list is actually really, a lot of the students really enjoy having that physical representation of it, because inside of your computer, it's kind of hard to understand, like, oh, these two items are being swapped. Well, where are they going? Do I need an extra space for them? Oh, well, I kind of do, because where's that person going to go if I want to be in their spot? And so it's helpful to think about all of the different options on where those pieces of data are going in your algorithm. And then we talk about, can a computer really solve any problem? And sort of the key example that we pick out here is the Alan Turing halting problem. So can you create a program that predicts whether a program can halt or not? And it's actually a very complex situation, and the computer can't actually figure that out. And so the big ideas that we cover here, data information, the algorithms again, and again, everything is sort of focused through that lens of programming. The next chapter that we move into is design, elegance, and efficiency. So up until this point, students have been writing code that probably works, probably looks nice. You know, they use a tool called Style 50 to help them abide by our style guide. But is it the most efficient? Is it the most elegant that it could possibly be? Probably not, right? So this section sort of focuses on, well, how can I make this code even more efficient than, say, what I learned from week zero to week whatever this week is in your school year? And one of those key ways of doing it is data encapsulation. So we talk about structs. So for example, you have a student in your class. What are some pieces of information you might want to know about a student? A name, okay. What else?
Their grade.
Their student ID number. Okay, but all of those things are essentially meaningless unless they're all tied to the same student. Right? If I just have a list of ID numbers and I have a list of names, and the names are sorted alphabetically and the numbers are sorted numerically, there isn't a one-to-one relationship of how those are being used together, and it might be difficult for me to try and tie those back together if they're both sorted differently. So structs sort of help us create almost a new custom data type that could sort of link all of those back to a student, such that I could access one student and then have access to their name, ID number, grade level, all of that. So it sort of cleans up what their data would look like to the computer. So chapter A, as you'll notice, all of the previous chapters were numbered, but chapter A is a letter, obviously. This is one of the optional chapters for students. So it's about managing data. And here do we cover some of the more complex aspects of CS50. So we talk about pointers and trees and hash tables. And for me, this is probably the hardest part of the course. It gets a little bit into the weeds on memory allocation and how things are represented in your computer. But definitely, definitely important to have students find some visual representation of that memory in their computer. Otherwise, it all seems a little abstract, especially to me. I had zero experience in computer science before taking CS50, and so this was by far the hardest part to get through. And then the next optional chapter is the developer toolbox. So here we cover some building abstractions, data compression, and scalability. So it's all fine and good if I can create a website and have some users sign up, but maybe my database only holds enough space for like 10 users, and then it's full, and that's it. How can we scale that? How can we make sure that we're using some concepts from security and privacy to really make sure that this platform is able to handle the hundreds or thousands of users that we may want to eventually put onto our site? And then chapter number 5 is networking and the internet. So this is where we sort of talk high level about how the internet works, what is routing, HTML and CSS. So students build a very simple website here just using, you know, just hypertext markup language and that cascading style sheets to create just some website that they want to build for themselves. So this is another aspect where they may address creativity. We've had students build personal websites, blogs, resumes even, and this is regarding the internet and global impact. And then lastly, chapter 6, problem solving in an internet connected world. So we have all these puzzle pieces. We have all of these concepts. We have the internet. We've talked about all of these things in the course. Now, how are we all going to tie that back to how this is impacting the world in front of us? So here we cover some of the more internet-focused problem sets. So we have Python, JavaScript, and another important sort of almost aside is the problems faced by modern computer scientists. So maybe I have a problem that I don't specifically know how to solve, but someone else has solved it out there for me already. How can we sort of leverage that work that other people have done to make our programs even better? So for example, Google Maps, right? It would be kind of tedious and almost dumb for companies who wanted to use a map feature to have to rebuild a map every single time they wanted to use it. Apps like Lyft, apps like Uber, they've all have map features to them. So instead of recreating this wheel that Google has already invented and done well, why don't we just leverage that and use their map and then create our business model on top of that, where our unique features creating a ride-sharing app. So those are our 9 chapters. But teachers often ask, and you know, as any AP teacher would note, well, what if I want to do my optional chapters after chapter 6? I want to go through all the numbers first and then go back to the letters because they're optional. And we say, you know, you can do whatever you want in your classroom, but I highly doubt that your students will want to go back and write programs in C after they've learned Python. And it is often the case that students just sort of gravitate to Python more because it's a little bit more readable and easier to understand the syntax of it all as compared to C. It's very verbose and arcane almost. So good luck trying to get your students to program in C after they've seen Python. So this is our sort of projected schedule for how these chapters would look. Obviously, I think more people spend some more time in chapter 1 and 2 than we've sort of represented here. But you know, it's totally up to you how you would like to pace out your class. This is just a suggestion. And if you have some sort of special circumstance in your classroom, maybe you only see your students once a week, but you see them for like 2 hours, versus a teacher who may see them like 45 minutes, 3 times a week, every week. You can definitely feel free to reach out to us and we can sort of help you troubleshoot how you might be able to cover all the content given your strange schedules. I know every school is different, so it often gets difficult to plan for the various schedule types that you all have. So this is where you will be able to find all of those resources, that AP portal that I mentioned at the beginning of this website, or at the beginning of these slides rather, cs50.harvard.edu/AP. And that's where you'll find all of our curricular resources, and that's how you'll be able to create your teacher account so that your students can see the resources that you've provided. And again, all of these slides are included on that link that I sent out earlier. And if you register with your CS50 AP workshop, it'll just help me sort of be able to identify who's here so that I can approve these accounts a little bit faster. We have sort of a process that we go through whenever we're vetting new teachers for our site. So this will just sort of expedite that process. All right, so that's all I have in terms of slides. I'd like to open this up sort of to all of you if you have questions or if there are specific circumstances that you have in your own classrooms. Yes?
A question. The students following CS50 are exposed to Scratch, C, and Python, but what do they use mainly for the create task?
So the question was, students are exposed to Scratch, C, and Python, but what do they mainly use for the create task? So we've had students use all of those languages for the create task. None is sort of valued more over the other. The really important factor is just what they're actually writing about in their written description of their program and less on the language. So it really doesn't matter. They could even use languages that aren't discussed in CS50. But I would say typically most of our students write their create programs in Python. Other questions?
This may be somewhere else, but in terms of actually setting up things for the kids so they can all get, you give them the URL for your, well, you know, your front end.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of submitting, I know this will be covered later, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they can submit with the instructor.
Yeah. So the question was, how do students get access to all of the tools? As we have the AP portal for high school teachers, what do the students have? So essentially, students will be guided to the specifications for the problems. And at the bottom of every problem set, it'll have those how to submit instructions, along with other tools that may be helpful in that specific problem, such as Check 50 or Style 50, or downloading any distribution code. All of that is in the problem specification.
But so that they don't need special registration?
They will need a GitHub account, but that's really all they will need to submit. Yes?
Erin, if we've already got our site, you don't want us to register again, correct?
Yeah, the question was, if you already have a site, do we need to register again? No, you should be all set. Yes?
I heard that there were tons of assessments, and I see the written prompts
mm-hmm.
and the programming problems. Mm-hmm. Are there, period-long assessment resources from which to choose?
So the question was, we have written assignments and we have programming assignments, but where can we find assessment-type questions? And we do have a resource called QuizBank. So if you visit quizbank.cs50.net, there is a complete list of questions that we've used for exams here on campus with our undergraduates. So you can, I believe, check off certain questions that you want to add to your quiz, and then it'll generate as a PDF or a Word document, and you can use that. Yep. Other question? Yes?
Just to add on to that response, too, once, if you choose to do this as an AP course on the College Board website, through the College Board login, their course audit site, you can get access to, I think it's like Reader Question Bank, and there's a whole set of 75 odd multiple choice questions by topics that you can access as well. Some are better than others, but it's another resource to have questions that are similar to the two practice exams the College Board gives.
And that's in our audit area?
That'll be through the College Board website.
In the audit area?
I think.
I haven't seen this thing you're talking about, I'm pretty sure.
It tracks it very well.
It's announced in the teacher community, the AP, AP teacher forum.
It's in the community.
Yeah.
They mention it. Somebody in that is actually, it's teacher created. And so if you kind of go through all those questions, you'll see a link to it or something.
Yeah. So all of that information is found on the AP College Board website. I also know that other curriculum will provide questions as well. So we have teachers who sort of pick and choose from different curricula. So code.org also has some questions. I believe Project Lead the Way also has some questions. So ours are a very specific type. And if you want to sort of mix up your pool of questions, you can definitely look around at the other curriculum.
So you kind of had your recommendation for timing the Explore task, and that was just to get it done. Mm-hmm. Sooner rather than later. Does anyone else have advice on timing those tasks for your classroom?
Yeah.
Down in Long Island, we just had a computer science teachers meeting in our region, and more than half of the teachers recommend you leave it for last.
Yeah.
Which I thought was
interesting. That's kind of what I thought, because the last unit was more about global impact, mm-hmm. that sort of connection. So I did it first.
But many of them were saying that they chose to do it last.
Mm-hmm. So the question was, how do we feel about pacing for the create task? And Rose over here was saying that, you know, people wait till sort of the end of a term to sort of work on that. We've had teachers who have done it very early on after Scratch, because you can submit a problem in Scratch and sort of get all of those tasks out of the way. Or if you want to sort of give your students some more tools in their toolbox before they sort of tackle it, most of our teachers wait until at least getting to the web development stuff before setting their students loose on the create task. Yes?
A big part of especially the create task, but also the explore task is the vocabulary you use around these things. To be able to talk about, to be able to write about algorithms and putting in one algorithm, including an algorithm inside another one. And I just think doing that early in the course would be crazy. I mean, hopefully you're teaching something.
Yeah.
getting that level of comfort to talk about the code you wrote seems worth to me to wait till the end.
Yeah. And we feel that as well. I mean, most of our students in CS50, at least for their final projects, very much use the sort of like previous week or week and a half of the content for their final projects. So very few people will do things in Scratch or C. I've actually never seen a final project in C alone. But I think it's just more powerful to have that wider set of tools to use. And can you do more interesting things with those set of tools than just with C or Scratch?
And just to note, if you choose to do a web app, then it's really going to be the Python or the JavaScript code that they want to see. Mm-hmm. HTML would not be graded.
Yeah, so in the create task, per the rubric, students will need to create algorithms and abstractions, and those things will be found in the Python or the JavaScript code. You couldn't really have the type of abstraction that they're looking for in HTML and CSS. Other questions? No? We're all good?
I have a question. If they submit their written answers, because I see that they can submit to GitHub. Does the Compare 50 work?
So
is that automatically done?
So Compare 50 isn't up and running yet. The question was, when students submit, will they automatically be run with Compare 50, which is one of our plagiarism checker tools? It's not complete yet. That's actually where David ran off to, is he's sitting in on a meeting about Compare 50 and its status right now. But in the future, essentially what we want to happen is when students submit, it'll automatically be run with Compare 50, such that it'll compare every student's submission with every other student's submission in your course. And those submissions will be ordered by list by percentage of how similar their code is to someone else's. And you'll be able to go in and review the at least top level responses, yeah.
Have them submit their writing.
Yes.
And would Compare 50 work on those? So that they were tested out relative to the larger population of students that have taken CS50 AP more than just, you know, the 15 kids in front of me, because I can do that.
Yeah.
But who knows where this stuff came
from. Yeah. So the question was, does Compare 50 essentially work on those writing assessments? And the short answer is it could. But Compare 50 was designed to specifically compare coding assignments, so it's optimized for matching code. If you're really concerned about students plagiarizing in a writing assignment, I would use some other platform, maybe Turnitin.com or something similar, because I think that that would check against a wider array, array of things that exist online.
But the code in the Compare 50 is only within the class. It's not looking at if kids went out onto the internet.
So the way that we sort of handle that on campus, and I'm not sure if this would necessarily work in your classrooms, is the way we're able to catch if students have sort of used something on GitHub is they're typically not the only person in the class who found that GitHub site. So we catch them because we're comparing those two students, and those two students use this one GitHub thing. We do have the potential to build in support for comparing it against all of the other CS50 submissions, in which case that would having it being compared against a larger pool would essentially give you those matches for someone who used the same site. But it's very difficult to be able to, for Compare 50 to just search the internet and scrape all of those repos that go up on GitHub nearly daily. Yeah. Anyone else?
I guess the students.
No, you can just kind of keep that under wraps. All right, well, I believe we have a 15-minute break for you to kind of get up and stretch your legs while we wait for the folks upstairs to sort of wrap up as well, but we will reconvene after that.